This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Lu Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
The temperatures are unseasonably cool here in the L-shaped studio, Ho-Ho-Lu Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. Nick Duke, I am Greg Phillips, and we have just gotten off our red-eye flight from Alabama to Vancouver by way of parts unknown. And we've got another edition of our show here, the hard-traveling fanboys, another edition of Countdown, which, of course, is where we count down the best, the worst, and everything in between in the history of comic books and comic book related media. And Nick, we've got a very, very special show here tonight, do we not?
Absolutely we do. You know, in honor of Father's Day, which is recently just passed, we are going to be counting down our top five dads in comics. And you know, we did this as a concept for the column back when we were writing those about 4 years ago. But we figured now would be a good time to revisit this topic and see how our lists have changed, if at all. But because we did this 4 years ago, we thought we needed something of a new and fresh perspective, and I think we certainly have that, Greg. Go ahead and tell everybody who our very special guest is here tonight.
Absolutely. And back in the column days, as you know, Nick, as our friend Jennifer Smith says, 1895 apparently, we did our own thing. But now we are reaching out, we're updating our lists, and we're reaching out to a newcomer to Place to Be Nation Pop, but not a newcomer to Place to Be Nation. We are reaching out to the former editorial director of – he just had a ton of titles here. The former man at Marvel, who is now teaching at UNLV and contributing right here at Place to Be Nation Pop. Ladies and gentlemen, we've reached out to a friend of the show who's been on a prior Countdown, in fact, a couple years ago. We reached out to Ben Morse, and he is here today.
Hello, hard-traveling fanboys. It is a pleasure to be on the longest-running weekly episodic podcast in Place to Be Nation Comics. What a treat. I'm so glad you guys are enjoying the temperatures up there in Vancouver. It is a sweltering 108 degrees here in Las Vegas, the entertainment capital of the world. I'm doing great. I'm ready to talk some dads with you guys tonight. Is the Countdown show named after the ill-fated DC Comics series of about a decade ago or so?
It's a combination of that and the WWE Network show, Countdown.
Oh, that's cool.
Had a similar level of success.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember when Countdown was way, way back when, because that was before I was at Marvel. That was when I was still at Wizard. Mm-hmm. And I remember one unnamed DC executive, or he will be unnamed, he or she be unnamed, quoted to me, "We're going to show them how to do 52 right."
Oh, God.
The Countdown.
Oh, God.
What a disaster. What a disaster that series was.
Not good.
And
it was a series that not only was bad, but it also fractured relationships with creators for
It destroyed everything. That was, I think I'm
class.
Yeah, Marvel Age Masterclass.
Damn it. I always get the branding wrong. Nick.
Yeah, it's okay.
You know, I'm just sitting here letting you hang yourself, essentially.
Yeah.
Marvel Age Masterclass, which is a great show. You started out with Russell Sellers, had Tim Cable, now you've got Todd Weber on. Tell us a little bit about Marvel Age Masterclass.
So the origins of Marvel Age Masterclass were Nick, Russell, Tim, and Todd started doing the Marvel Age podcast, which I'm a big fan of. And initially, I was going to be a guest in one of the episodes. It's, of course, the year-by-year history of Marvel Comics, of the Marvel Universe, starting from 1961, 1962, and proceeding forward. I thought it was a great concept. I basically determined that if I came on an episode, I wouldn't get enough time to talk because there were four other people. So my solution was to trick Nick into giving me my own show where I would borrow...
No tricks necessary, sir. No tricks necessary.
Where I'd borrow one host, basically make them sit there and listen to me talk for 2 hours, periodically saying, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That sounds great. So basically just me, like, super villain monologuing...
Yes.
...about my experiences at Marvel Comics and my love for Marvel Comics of the Silver Age. Fun fact, I was doing some work for the podcast the other day, and I was looking into some Fantastic Four stuff. And I really came to love the Fantastic Four while I was at Marvel. And it's funny because when I was a kid, I could not stand the Fantastic Four. I thought they were the worst. I thought they were just a terrible, like, I said this on the show, but I don't think, you know, people like the Thing and the Human Torch, but, like,
right.
No one thinks the Fantastic Four are cool. Like, they're just...
No, ugh. I've never grown out of that.
I mean, no kids of our, like, generation, I know you're a little older than I am, but, like, it just isn't a thing. There aren't young kids who are huge fans of Reed Richards anymore. I don't know, for whatever reason, you know?
But there was something about when I was at Marvel... Number one, I went back and read the Lee Kirby stuff. I read like the first 100 issues of Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it lives up to the hype. It's so good. And that kind of turned me on. But really, what turned me on to the FF more than anything, because I was thinking, like, you know, there were some great runs on that. Byrne had a great mm-hmm. run. I like Tom DeFalco's run. And then, like, Jonathan Hickman had a great run. But really, it was... The guy who is kind of like, I consider him like my Marvel Comics trivia mentor. And that would be Tom Brevoort, who is the executive editor / senior vice president over at Marvel. I think still. He might have gotten promoted since I left. But we used to sit down and do podcasts, and people would argue it was because Tom and I were the only two people at Marvel who just were like encyclopedic and could just open up and talk about anything for hours, and it was such a joy because he knows much more than I do, and I know a fair amount about comics, but like Tom was just a fount of information, and he really, like, we did when the Fantastic Four, what was it, it's a 60 70 80 when they, what was it, 50 years of the Fantastic Four or more than that, whatever their last anniversary was, Tom and I sat down and did a podcast. We recorded one episode for every decade that the Fantastic Four had been in existence. And it was like a love affair with me and the Fantastic Four had started. So yeah, dads and comics.
Which, hey!
Reed Richards is a dad!
Perhaps we'll see Reed Richards on your list here in a minute.
We'll see. That was me talking about Marvel Masterclass. That was an example, guys. That was a plug on the type of thing you can hear on Marvel Masterclass. Me just going completely... off kilter, yep. And talking about something not related to the topic for at least 5 minutes or so. So there, if you enjoyed that, then please listen to Marvel Age Masterclass.
Absolutely. I highly recommend it. And while we're spitballing here, based on Marvel Age Masterclass, your theory on Dr. Doom was very, very interesting to both Nick and I. Made me see him in it because I objectively know that Dr. Doom is a great villain, but I've never read what I think is a great Dr. Doom story. Mm. And so, because I just haven't been exposed to it enough. But, like, mm-hmm. hearing your theory about this guy that can do all these great things, but he's just consumed by his hatred of Reed Richards that overrides everything else, that's extremely compelling.
Yeah, especially, Doug, when you talked about Secret Wars on the recent one, because Greg will tell you, I read Secret Wars having not really read any of Jonathan Hickman's Fantastic Four run and only a small amount of his Avengers run. But I was intrigued by the concept. And so I remember reading Secret Wars, and then you get to the end and I go, wow, this is really a Fantastic Four story all along.
It was a Fantastic Four story
and
the whole time.
And didn't know it until the end. And I was like, my God, that's amazing and brilliant. And it makes me like appreciate the Fantastic Four in a way I've never really appreciated them before.
It's crazy because it's like... Hickman didn't start out at Marvel doing Fantastic Four, but it was the first, like, big project he worked on. You know, like, he did Secret Warriors, mm-hmm. and then Fantastic Four was basically the start, though, of his epic multi-year story.
Yep.
Like, the thing about Hickman is he would come into the Marvel... I remember him coming into the Marvel Writers Retreats, and he would just have these charts. And Bendis would just be like, what is wrong with you? He's like, why do you have charts? It's charts like he had, like, for Secret Warriors, like, this is what I'm going to tell over the next 5 years. And, like, people would be like, what if it gets canceled? He's like, it can't get canceled. I have plans. And so he was just this mad genius. And his story that started in Fantastic Four, ran through all of Avengers, and eventually went to Secret Wars, that was all, like, he had conceived of Secret Wars when he did his first issue of Fantastic Four. Like, that was always the end game, was to do this giant Fantastic Four story, because he just loves the FF, and specifically Reed and Doom so much. So the cool thing for me was, when I was working at Marvel, is, of course, one of the things you always heard all the time was, oh, Marvel hates the Fantastic Four because Fox owns them. Marvel hates the X-Men because Fox owns them. And, you know, whether or not sometimes they were those properties were de-emphasized because of movies or whatever, you know, I can't really speak to. But what I can speak to was, we just thought it was so cool that, like, because everyone thought we were de-emphasizing Fantastic Four, and because everyone thought we had moved away from, like, considering FF an important title, we knew that when kind of the floor dropped out in Secret Wars and you realized, like you guys did, that it was an FF story, we're like, no one is going to see this coming because they think we're doing all this stuff to try to move away from the Fantastic Four, when really Hickman is telling this amazing Fantastic Four story that stretches over, like, years and years of storytelling with every character and every reality, and just, it was insane. So
it's a little bit like modern wrestling booking in a way, if you think about it, where you're playing with the expectations of people who know how the inner workings of the business work. So, for instance, if you've read a story about how, I'm just going to throw a random example out here, let's say Rusev is not liked backstage or is not considered a big-time player backstage, hey, now we can do an angle with Rusev where he shockingly becomes number one contender for the championship.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's a little bit playing off of expectations. So,
yeah.
With that being said, it is a celebration of Father's Day here. Ben's a father. Nick's a father. I am not. But I am the father of this podcast. A co-father, if you will. And so what we're going to do is we're going to count down our list of the best comic book dads. And I don't know about you guys, but one thing I realized when putting together my list, there aren't a whole lot of great comic book dads.
No. Terrible fathers pretty much across the board in comic books. There are some standouts. I, like, when I was composing my list, I definitely had to stretch a little bit and find some. Yeah, but on the whole, there's not good dads in comic books. We could probably very easily do a list of worst comic book fathers, and it would be much more plentiful.
We might have to expand countdown to 10 or 15.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Nick, I noticed your echo filled voice in the background. What are your thoughts on the relative dearth of good comic book fathers?
You know, it's like you guys said, the landscape is a little bare. I think I've sat down to make my preliminary list and I came up with like 9 names, but even that, like Ben was saying, was a little bit of a stretch. So, you know, we'll just have to see how our lists go. As we mentioned, or I don't know. Yeah. We mentioned earlier, we did do this a little bit. We did the same countdown as a column years ago. So I'm interested to see how our list changed, Greg, and how, Ben's perspective on the topic comes in.
Absolutely. So I will go ahead and get us started with my entry at number 5 on my list of the greatest comic book dads, and I have got Commissioner James Gordon.
Ooh, good pick. Yep. I didn't even think of him.
He, of course, is the father of Barbara Gordon, a.k.a. Batgirl, a.k.a. Oracle, and also the father, unfortunately, of a serial killer named James Gordon Jr. But for the purposes of my list, I'm focusing on his relationship with his daughter, Babs. And the thing about Jim Gordon is, I think maybe more than any character in the Batman mythos, he's a man of honor and integrity. And while he's not perfect by any means, he has affairs. He smokes heavily. He makes questionable decisions in the heat of the moment. But the one thing that he's never wavered in is his love and support of his daughter. And I think it takes a special kind of dad to support a child in a city as dangerous as Gotham. You can make the argument of why would he even live there if he wanted to protect his daughter. But if you read these stories, Jim Gordon's love of Barbara overrides everything. It overrides his duty to the force. It overrides his sense of commitment to his spouse at the time. And it certainly overrides his commitment to Batman. And we've seen throughout the years, whether it was Barbara getting shot by the Joker, whether it was Barbara's return to being Batgirl after her injuries, and even in his dealings with his son, James Gordon Jr., we have seen this man do everything in his power to help his children first and foremost. And so for me, while he may not be a perfect dad, I think Jim Gordon is the perfect example of a great dad, because I think it's less the mistakes you make and more how you learn from them.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly, Greg, so much so that I'm not really going to say much right now, because I'll have a little bit more to say on Jim Gordon as we delve further into my list. But Ben, your reaction to Greg's inclusion of Jim Gordon?
I think it's a good pick, and also demonstrates the depth or lack thereof we're working with here, when you basically say, like, if you can go 1 for 2 and not really serial killers, like, you're on the list. You're the fifth best dad in comics. Like, as long as you hit 500, and, like, one of your kids ended up becoming a superhero, even if the other one is the scum of humanity, good job, Jim Gordon. You know, like, you kind of did it.
World's fifth best dad?
I
look at it as, if you stay above the Mendoza line, at least you're doing okay. You know, you're not Magneto or
Deathstroke. More like above the Menendez line.
Oh my god,
that was awesome.
That's the kind of pop culture reference I'm looking for. Yep. So let's make a Ben sandwich right now, and let's go right over to Ben for your number 5 selection on your list.
All right, so my number 5 selection is a little outside the box, and you're going to have to bear with me for a little while.
Okay.
Because I have to explain why this guy makes number 5. And that, to me, he's not just any father. He's the all-father.
Oh,
and that is
okay.
Odin. And now you might be thinking, Odin, he's such a dick. He's terrible to his sons.
Hey, we're dealing with the Menendez line right now.
I am exactly thinking that, so I'm interested to hear your reasoning.
No, but here's my pitch for Odin, is that he is the ultimate tough love dad.
Okay.
No one makes more of a commitment to trying to better his children than Odin. He literally banishes Thor to Earth to teach him humility, which is an important lesson for any kid to learn. Gives Loki multiple chances to reform, despite the fact he clearly has no interest in it. He's just generally very overprotective of his sons. See it in his treatment of Jane Foster and just general. He's a grouchy, grumpy, very difficult, hard man. But I truly believe at the heart of Odin's character is a true love specifically for Thor and wanting Thor to be the best god he can possibly be. Now, does that mean he's going to seem a little unfair, pig-headed, and just, you know, boorish sometimes? Yes, absolutely. He definitely has done things that seem questionable at best. But I will contend that at the end of the day, Odin's motivation is always for the good, not only of Asgard, but for the good of his son. Also, he's also Baldur's dad,
mm-hmm.
and like never acknowledged that until Baldur. Were he and Baldur even alive at the same time during the time Baldur knew he was his dad. I don't know. I think Baldur found out Odin was his dad when Odin was dead, and then Baldur died, and then Odin came back.
You've got it.
And, yeah, I don't think they overlap.
That is the timeline of that, yes.
That is the timeline of that. But, yeah, that's my pitch. Odin, unconventional father, probably not methods I'm going to use with my own daughter. But
you're not
going
to banish her to another realm?
Not going to banish her to another realm, unless she's really, really arrogant, like Thor was. But no, I think Odin is a special kind of conflict with death.
And if you do wind up banishing your daughter to another realm, whenever she brings her significant other back home for you to meet him or her, just make sure you're an overbearing douche to that person, and be really surprised by the fact that, you know, your child would spend years among these people and actually grow to care for them, and be really upset about that.
It really it's so funny that Odin's the one who sends him to Earth, and yet Odin just seems to hate Earth so much.
Right,
hate Midgard.
You actually liked Midgard?
Yeah,
that wasn't the point at all.
That was a punishment. You were supposed to learn your lesson. Oh man! But back when I used to do the This Week in Marvel podcast, we would just delight in Odin the asshole and just like what a prick he was to not only his children but to his wife, to any woman. Just a monster of a person.
Well, you guys,
my number five pick on the best dads of all time.
You guys kind of got to do This Week in Marvel during the rebirth of Odin, because there for several years before Jason Aaron took over, they had softened Odin to such a degree that it almost was a completely different character than what we used to read back in the old, you know, Simonson run and before that. And Jason Aaron definitely leaned into and brought back the more prickly aspects of his personality. So
for sure. Yeah. Jason Aaron writes one of the best grumpy, grizzly Odins of them all.
Absolutely. One of my favorite characters in his run. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned batting 500 with Jim Gordon. Kind of the same thing with Odin. You know, you have one good one bad one. And
You got Baldur there, too. So he's batting, batting 667.
He's batting 667. Baldur was a
good
pickup there.
Or I guess now we have to consider Angela, and I don't really know where you would count her as well.
That's true.
Is that a positive or a negative? You know,
I think she's net positive. She's a guardian of the galaxy, off and on.
But see, we're not even thinking about all the bastards out there.
Let's not get into that.
So, next up, we have Nick with your selection at number five.
Yeah. So I talked a little bit about how I was interested to see how our list would change from what they were 4 years ago. And no better way to see that change than right here, because I'm going to talk about a character that 4 years ago was not a dad at all. And at number five, I have got Superman on my list. The introduction of John Kent over the last few years, by Dan Jurgens in the pages of first Superman, Lois and Clark, and then later with the Rebirth era Superman, has just been one of my favorite things. You know, I've talked extensively about how Superman is a character that I've often had trouble relating to. I'm definitely one of those people who finds him unapproachable at times and unrelatable. And when they added the John Kent character and brought back the marriage, it kind of spoke to me in a way that no Superman story had done before. And I wound up reading, as Greg knows, pretty much, you know, the first entire year of both Superman and Action Comics. And I have just been blown away by his relationship with his son, the way they have developed John to this point, the way they, you know, portray the parental unit, and the way that Superman is able to take on the best aspects of Pa Kent while also being his own distinct father, because he has more knowledge and experience with dealing with the idea of powers and how that affects, you know, how you're going to parent a child who is dealing with these life-altering powers that he doesn't really know what to make of. So pretty much everything they have done with Superman, with Clark, and John over the last 3 years has just been amazing to me, and I am beyond excited to see how Brian Michael Bendis handles that relationship going forward, given that he did Jessica Jones' motherhood angle so well over in the pages of Avengers and Jessica Jones. So big fan of that dynamic, and can't wait to see where it goes in the years ahead.
Yeah, this is a nice pick, Nick. And in fact, I actually had Superman penciled in to my number five spot, and I removed him at the last minute because I remembered one of my favorite comic book covers of all time, which, of course, is Jimmy Olsen giving him the Father's Day gift and Superman being so disappointed in it that he burns it in front of him.
Yeah. But awesome. That's, you know, Jimmy had to learn.
Tough love, right?
I'm all about tough love.
Yeah.
I'm gonna hold off on commenting on Superman because I may
sweet
may have something to say about him later.
Awesome. Good to hear.
Yeah. Let's get on to my somewhat unique number four selection here.
Okay.
And this is one that I have to confess. I have not read this entire run to say that if things might change later on, I don't know. Ben can speak to this better than I can.
Uh-oh.
But my number four character is actually the original Starman, Ted Knight.
Mm. Oh, boy.
Now, this is an interesting one, because when Starman begins, Ted Knight is not a good father to his son. In fact, he's isolated him because his son has different interests than him. His son's not interested. Jack is not interested in getting into the family trade. And I think many of us in the comic book fan community can relate to Jack Knight. And I think that's one of the things about Starman that appealed to people is the fact that this was a character who a lot of us had grown up maybe not interested in the things that our fathers were interested in and dealing with the associated feelings of disappointment, even if that wasn't expressly stated. But I think what makes Ted Knight a great father, other than his role in Caddyshack, of course, is the fact that he learns lessons along the way. Because I think one of the things that I've noticed about my friends that are fathers, but especially about my own father, is how he can look back at his early days and see things that maybe he did wrong, that maybe he wishes he had done better. And you can't change the past, but what you can do is change the present and adapt with that. And I think what Ted does, at least through the four or five trade volumes I've read of Starman at this point, how he grows into his relationship with Jack, it feels more real, I think, than a lot of father-son relationships in comics. You know, I mentioned earlier about Jim Gordon and Barbara and their relationship. And if I had a complaint about that, it would be that at times it's almost unnaturally close, almost to the point that it's hard to buy at times because they're so just they agree on pretty much everything. They're always there for each other, and that's great in principle. But in real life, things happen. There are rifts that happen between two people, whether they're father and son, mother and daughter, whatever. And I really appreciate how we see that rift in this series. And we also see how that rift gets bridged as it goes on. So perhaps a controversial choice, but I stand by it. Ted Knight, my number four father.
So are you reading Starman now?
Very intermittently. We read a few volumes for the Longbook Hunters, and I have gotten like four volumes in, I think, completed.
Well, I'm not going to spoil it for you, because Starman is one of the best comics of all time. It's right up there with the Golden Age as James Robinson's masterpiece. Ted Knight, not a great father. 0-for-2 on your list. Commissioner Gordon and Ted Knight. No, I'm just kidding. No, I like your rationale a lot. I think Ted Knight is certainly not going to win any Father of the Year awards, but, absolutely displays adaptability and a willingness to change at an advanced age that I think is admirable. And you've still got some good stuff coming up. I won't spoil it. But I do enjoy the Ted-Jack dynamic. And also the fact that it's so interesting that, you know, Ted had two sons, and the one that he, you know, that worshipped him ended up, you know, dying. And then Jack was kind of, you know, what was left over. And these two guys, they have the specter of David Knight in between them, and they have to overcome that and like become close to each other. It's such a good story, and it's a really good pick because I think it's an unconventional pick, but really highlights a really cool father-son relationship in the DC universe, which is all about legacy. Or at least it used to be. I don't know if it is anymore. But it's so much about legacy and so much about fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and all that. And also, Ted Knight scored with the original Black Canary.
Oh,
so,
snap! I don't think I even knew that.
Yeah, that's I may have just gone back on my word and spoiled something in Starman for you.
No, hey, you've given me something to look forward to.
But yeah, if you read Mark Waid and Barry Kitson's JLA Year One, mm-hmm. which is one of my favorite JLA stories, there's a little nod to that relationship, which is a lot of fun. So,
Nick, I know you have limited exposure to Starman just through our Longbook Hunters, but what are your thoughts on this pick?
Yeah, I mean, your rationale is very sound. One of the things that kind of helped me shape my list, in certain selections anyway, is I was looking for fathers that were relatable, because as someone who is a father himself, you know, some of the typical father ideals in comics, Pa Kent, for example, he's so damn good at it that it's just frustrating to read, you know? Like, I can't find that connection to it, because I'm like, God, I'll never be, you know, one half the dad that this guy is. But with Ted Knight, like you were saying, there is an element of real world feel about it, and it helps it to ground the story and ground that dynamic. So, good pick, I think.
Yeah, very good pick.
Thanks a lot, guys. Let's move on to Ben with your number four selection, sir.
All right, my number four pick will not surprise anyone who knows me. Actually, it might a little bit. I'll take you guys on a little bit of an odyssey into my thoughts here. So my favorite comic book character of all time, most likely, is Wally West, the one true Flash. And when Wally became a father during Jeff Johns' run on Flash, I hated it because I was in my 20s. I thought kids were lame, and I was just like, oh, this destroys Wally's character. It makes him seem so old, and this is bad, and him and Linda aren't cool anymore. So I really turned hard on it. So now, flash forward. Oh, wow. Pun there. Flash forward about a decade or so, and I'm a father myself. And there is a storyline going on right now in the pages of Flash by Joshua Williamson and Howard Porter, where Wally is rediscovering his children. And it just tugs on the heartstrings for me. And it made me reconsider retroactively the entire run of Wally West, Dad. Initiated by Jeff Johns, contributed to by Mark Waid, so, you know, the two best Wally writers of all time. And just, there was something about Wally who I always found him so relatable. Just one, like I said, my favorite character in comics, just because he is one of the few characters who grows. Him and Dick Grayson are the two who have evolved over time. And it's just like, he grew up. He became the Flash. He became an adult. And what better way to advance his story than by making him a father? And he's such a versatile character, loves his kids so much, just made to be a dad. That was kind of the cool thing, was he was a character who you got to know through so many different incarnations, whether you're reading about him in New Teen Titans as Kid Flash, or when in Crisis he takes over for Barry, and then he kind of stumbles through his 20s, basically, and, like, finds his footing, and then finally, you know, just becomes, by the time Johns is writing him, just this awesome adult who's so good at it. Like, just good at being married, good at being a hero, good at being a friend, and then becomes a dad, and that's, like, the most challenging thing, but he loves his twins so much, and he just commits to becoming a family. There wasn't really a long time for them to explore Wally West as a dad, because Barry came back, and then there was Flashpoint, and there was all this stuff going on, but I'm glad they're getting back to it in the current Flash run, because I think if ever there was a character who really just, of course, should make the next evolutionary step in his personal life into being a parent, it's Wally West, because we've seen him grow from a kid to a man, to the man, to no, this is the next step for him. So I'm hopeful. Obviously, I don't know what the outcome of Flash War is going to be, but it's crazy that, like, 10 years ago, I hated the idea of Wally as a dad, and now I'm, like, rooting hard for them to bring that back to mythology, because I think it really distinguishes him and makes him a special character.
I love this pick so much that when we did the column, he made my list, I think, at number five. And I came to the Geoff Johns, in particular, Flash run, a lot later than everybody else did. I came after I had been reading his Green Lantern, went back and got the trades, and read a lot of that run. And one other aspect of any great parent is a willingness to sacrifice for their child. Mm. And I think, and sometimes make the wrong decision, because I think you know where I might be going with the encounter that he has with Zoom, and he has to make a decision that is, you could argue, is a selfish decision, but it's a selfish decision to protect and give life to his children. Yeah. And it's a decision that really, like, that whole Blitz storyline affected me emotionally a lot more than I was expecting for a story that I had already had spoiled for me. Mm-hmm. But to actually see it, and I think it demonstrates exactly what you're talking about with Wally.
Absolutely. There's another great moment in Infinite Crisis when, you know, Wally's running basically to his end, his death, whatever, merging with the Speed Force, and he, like, pops back to, you know, do the typical superhero thing, say goodbye to his wife and kids, and say, like, you know, I'm making this big sacrifice, and then Linda and the kids basically, or, well, not the kids, they're too young to make a decision at that point, so this is actually probably a selfish decision on Linda's point of view, but the fact that Linda says, no, we're coming with you, and then they eventually, you know, sacrifice together. Just a beautiful moment. And I really have come around on the idea of Wally being a father.
Very good. Now, Nick, how does this transition into your number four?
Well, it doesn't really at all, but I will say that, you know, my number four pick is one that we've already talked about a little bit, so I won't spend too much time here. Jim Gordon, for all the reasons that Greg outlined, he is a man who has so many responsibilities, a responsibility to the city of Gotham, a responsibility to the officers that serve on his force, and a responsibility to Batman. And yet, with all those responsibilities, he takes none of them as seriously as he does his responsibility to his daughter. So, for all those reasons, Jim Gordon gets a big thumbs up from me.
Yeah. And again, raise the serial killer.
Very good.
Just so we don't forget that.
Yes, he's having trouble staying above the Menendez line, but we're hoping he doesn't fall below that in the future.
Also,
but,
a heavy smoker, which is a bad look.
Do you think Barbara has asthma? I don't know. I'd have to consult my DC encyclopedia on that one.
I don't know, man.
But nonetheless, that brings me to my number three, and this is actually a gentleman that I left off my list when I did the column a few years ago, and since then I've come to my senses, I've come to my realization. And I know I just gave a big spiel about how Ted Knight deserved to make my list because he was a realistic father that was not the ideal, that was not the just perfect all the time. And I'm going to instead throw on someone here at number three that is perfect all the time, that is the ideal, that is sort of the pastiche of the kindly father figure that imparts wisdom on his young ward. And in this case, that is going to be Ben Parker.
Mm.
Of course, the uncle of Peter Parker, the Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
For a long time, I had issues with Uncle Ben and Aunt May. They never really worked for me, particularly Uncle Ben. Aunt May a little bit more so. But Uncle Ben just always seemed like this ghostly figure. I guess because when I grew up reading Spider-Man, he was older already. You know, this was a Spider-Man that was already, I think, past college when I started reading. Early 90s, late 80s era. And so Uncle Ben, much like Bruce Wayne at that point with his parents, it was an event so far in the past that it felt like it had lost its relevance to my young mind. So I looked more to Spider-Man's relationships with other heroes. I looked more to his recent losses and things of that nature. But if you really whittle the character down, and I think listening to the Marvel Age podcast and Marvel Age Masterclass really helped remind me of this, that if you whittle the character down, it still goes back to that ultimate mistake that he makes that leads Uncle Ben's death and his memory of the lessons that Uncle Ben passed on to him. Mm-hmm. With great power comes great responsibility. It's a cliche at this point, but it's a cliche for a reason. That's because it's stuck. It's stuck in pop culture, and it's stuck in Spider-Man for all this time. And so Uncle Ben couldn't control when he left the Earth, when he left Peter behind. All he could control was what he did while he was there. And I think what's obvious as you see the hero that Peter Parker grows into, the building blocks were laid there by Uncle Ben at a very early age, along with Aunt May. But while May is able to kind of help guide Peter as he ages, it's there from the beginning, because you guys have talked on both shows about how Peter Parker very easily could have turned into a supervillain given his origins, but he doesn't. And why doesn't he? I would argue it is the moral compass and the ethical code that was instilled in him at a young age by an uncle who I am counting as a father, because for all intents and purposes, to paraphrase Yondu, he may not have been his father, but he was his daddy.
Hmm. Great pick. Tremendous. Goes a long way towards legitimizing your otherwise shitty list. No, Uncle Ben is one of the greatest father figures in the history of comics. So formative to the best origin possibly in the history of comics. And consider this. This is a guy who was not raising his own son. This is his deadbeat brother's son, who he had to take in because his parents had died. And just like the circumstances by which Aunt May and Uncle Ben become parents, I think is very interesting. I don't think it gets talked about or explored enough. We certainly haven't talked about it on our shows enough, is the fact that they didn't ask for this kid. They didn't plan for this kid. They were two old people who were like ready to enjoy their twilight years together, just doing what old people do. And then this kid came into their life and they were just filled with love for him, and it transformed them. And Uncle Ben has the advantage, I think, of, you know, technically only having one appearance. There are flashbacks, of course, and, you know, tricks and stuff like that. But really, I mean, he's an amazing fantasy, and then he dies. But he didn't have a lot of time to accrue any negative qualities. And writers have been pretty good. They treat him, he's a pretty sacred, sacred character in the sense that there haven't been a lot of retcons to say, you know, he was secretly a degenerate gambler or something. Like, Uncle Ben's been, he's remained pretty pristine. And yeah, just what you said, Greg, about, you know, great power comes great responsibility, sums up Uncle Ben, sums up Peter Parker, and just one of the best. There's a place in heaven for Uncle Ben and Jonathan Kent where they're hopefully just playing catch and drinking beers and just enjoying the fruits of their afterlife.
Yeah, I will once again withhold comment, but I'll have a little bit more to say than Greg does later on, because as Greg knows, I will come at it from a little bit of a different perspective.
You might even say an ultimate perspective.
That's true. Oh, good. I'm glad we're going to talk about that. I was going to mention that.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
I'll hold off and let Nick do it.
Okay.
I appreciate that about Ben Parker, and regret leaving him off my list last time. But let's move on.
I think you may have turned things around here.
Let's move on to Nicholas with your to Ben with your number three selection.
So if Wally West was the guy who was definitely like meant to be a dad, and we're like, probably all his friends, all the other Titans were like, oh yeah, you know, he'll settle down and have kids early, you know, good Midwestern kid and all that. My third pick is the guy who you didn't know how he was going to do, but being a dad turned out to be the best thing that could have ever happened to him and completely transformed him as a character. I'm talking about the original Power Man, the hero for hire, Luke Cage.
Not to derail you, but I will go ahead and say this is also my number three pick. So
all right, so we can tag team this one. Yes. Kind of go back and forth on this one, but I just think that Luke Cage for the first 30 to 40 years of his existence was a great character, but you know, he was a bad boy. He was he was a wild child. He was out there living hard and kind of doing what he wanted, not being accountable to anybody. Everyone has that friend, you know, that friend who's just kind of out of control. He's the life of the party. And then he knocks a girl up and we find out what kind of man he really is. Mm-hmm. And in Luke Cage's case, he turned out to be quite a man. Yeah. He owned up to his responsibility, settled down, you know, put his other ways behind him. And so many great stories, mostly from Brian Bendis, but, you know, from a lot of people about Luke being the father to this little girl, Danielle, just being committed to Jessica Jones. And I like him as a husband, but I like him more as a dad. I just think, like, his tender moments, how much he wants to put his family first, how much he wants to protect them, just what a principled, great guy he is. And we often talked at Marvel about the fact that it was insane that Luke Cage went from being where Luke Cage was in the early 2000s when Bendis brought him into Alias, to being the legitimate leader of the Avengers and a guy that everybody respected. And I think a big reason he got there was because he was put through that trial by fire of being a father. And it was just one of those cases where a guy unexpectedly rose to the occasion, and it was just, it was great. So, Nick, I'll tag out to you. You can say your piece on the case.
No, you're absolutely right in that regard, because, you know, and you and I probably can speak to this a little bit. Fatherhood is one of those things where you're either going to sink or you're going to swim. Like, you're going to fail miserably, or you're going to figure out a way to make it work. And a lot of people, it becomes this transformative experience for them, and they wind up becoming almost the best versions of themselves as a result. And I think Luke Cage is the character in comics you could say that the most about. Like, I mean, you outlined all the stuff. I mean, honestly, there's something so beautiful about that Luke and Jessica relationship, in that you have two broken people who come together to build something that is truly remarkable and beautiful. Like, their relationship with their daughter, especially as it was portrayed in the pages of the most recent Jessica Jones series, is one of the most realistic and wonderful representations of parenthood I've seen in a comic book in my life. Specifically, they're having spats, and, like, there are scenes where they're livid with one another, but their daughter says something, like, cute and adorable, and it's like the entire world stops for a moment, and they forget how angry they are with one another, because they're both so in love with their daughter. And like you said, that sense of responsibility inspired Luke to become more than he ever thought he could be, the legitimate leader of the Avengers. And also, for me, it's so cool to see a representation of a non-traditional interracial family unit and see it portrayed in a mostly positive light. I mean, that is one of, you know, Bendis' entire Jessica Jones catalog, I think, is a fantastic contribution to the medium. But that particular relationship and how they've handled Danielle to this point is probably his greatest contribution to the medium.
Yeah.
So
very well said.
Yep. So there you are. I mean, for all those reasons, Luke Cage is a character I just, before he became a dad, I didn't know much about him and I didn't care that much about him. And it has, like, completely done a 180 on that character for me.
Yep.
Yeah, I've got to read more of Luke Cage's dad, because I'll be honest, my main exposure to Luke Cage comes from the TV universe on Netflix. So I've got to read some of this Bendis run of Jessica Jones and Alias and
New
so
Avengers.
On. Indeed, all of that stuff. Yeah, and Marvel Unlimited makes it all available to me.
It's all possible through Marvel Unlimited.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on. Alias.
Oh, yeah, you can't read Alias.
that's a good point. Right.
You're going to have to buy the trades for that one.
But they're well worth it.
Let's move on to number two. And with my number two selection, I'm going back to the well of another outside-the-box choice. Oh, but one that I have to say made an emotional impact on me because of the emotional impact he had on his son. And that would be John Custer from the pages of Garth Ennis's Preacher, one of my favorite comic book series of all time, if not the. John Custer is an interesting case because there's probably a lot of bad about John Custer, but we're seeing him through the lens of his son, by and large. And in his son's eyes, his dad is not just a normal man. He's a Paul Bunyan-like figure, a figure of moral righteousness and badassery. And we do get to see a little bit of his past about dealing with fighting in a war he didn't believe in, with coming back home and having a family that didn't approve of his wife, of his son, of anything that was going on in his personal life, having to battle these forces on all sides of him the whole time. And yet, the thing about John Custer is he has a moral code that, while it may not match everyone else's moral code, he sticks by it. And he sticks by it no matter what happens. He doesn't move it. He doesn't move his line back. He doesn't allow himself to be pushed off of that line. And it's really summed up in a passage I'm going to read here from Preacher, where his last words to Jesse, actually, before he goes off and suffers an unfortunate fate, he says, "You got to be a good guy, Jesse. You got to be like John Wayne. You don't take no shit off fools, and you judge people by what's in them, not how they look. And you do the right thing. You got to be one of the good guys, son, because there's way too many of the bad." And that, just that one instance of taking his son aside and giving him this message sets our hero of the story, Jesse Custer, on the entire journey that defines the book, that defines the character, that defines one of the great comic book series of all time. And for me, I know it's another outside-the-box choice, but we're dealing with a limited field here, and I think the perception from his son is enough to elevate John Custer for me into this mythical Greatest Dads collection.
I think it's a good pick. Preacher's a great book. I think you hit on it, Greg. It's just like that father-son dynamic is so much more important to Preacher and to the development of Jesse Custer than you initially realize. And Jesse Custer is just such a wonderfully complex character. There's just so many layers to him and so many different directions you can go. And I like that you hit upon the influence of his dad. Look, Jesse's not perfect. John's not perfect, but they both did their best. I think there's something to that. I think, you know, when it comes to parenting and being a father, you do the best you can, and you just hope that you can leave something for your kids to aspire to. And I think that's exactly what he did. And also, unlike Jim Gordon, did not raise a serial killer. So definitely deserves to be higher than that scumbag Jim Gordon.
That bastard Jim Gordon.
Yeah.
Nick, I know you're just as big a Preacher fan as I am. What are your thoughts on John Custer?
It's obviously a pick that I'm a big fan of. I tried to find a way to get John Custer on the list, but he was unfortunately edged out by that bastard Jim Gordon. So
yeah, you know, I was going to say, it wasn't hard to get him on the list. Just leave Jim Gordon off.
Well,
they are heavy smokers, but one is not dealing with a psychopathic serial killer son.
Yep.
And one does have a lighter that says "fuck communism," so we're good with that. I mean, that's a pretty good, pretty nice touch to that character. But
sure,
you know, you guys covered it pretty well. John Custer, because of the impact he has on Jesse, and like Ben kind of alluded to, it's a story that you don't really realize the father-son dynamic is going to be nearly as important to as it winds up becoming. And that reveal and that development of this relationship after the fact through flashback is actually one of the more poignant things in the entire series. So great pick, Greg.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, I know you've got something waiting on us. You've got something big here at number two. What do you got?
I am going to just credit Nick and say Superman is my number two because I still have
him. Nice.
No, look, I think Superman as a dad, and Nick already said this better than I'm going to be able to, but Superman as a dad is the most natural yet awesome move in recent comics history. It just makes sense. Like, there are so many characters who you want to see as perpetually young. That's the, you know, the whole Spider-Man dilemma when he was married and they had to unmarry him and all that. But the idea that some of these characters are not that. Superman is a guy who has always been in his 30s. Let's just put it like it is. Like, this was never, other than the Superboy story, this was never a kid. This was always a full-grown man. Mm-hmm. And he was at his best when he was married to Lois Lane.
Yep.
That was, it made sense. I wanted, like, as much as I cringed when Spider-Man was married, I was always like, nope, Superman being married makes sense. He's like the, he's your dad. Like, he's your dad you're reading about in comics. He's, whereas you want to be Spider-Man, you want Superman to be your dad. And that they finally took that step and gave him a kid. And it's funny because the way they initially did it was in the pages of Superman, Lois, and Clark, where it's like, oh, you know, it's a, or actually even before that in Convergence, the idea that like, oh yeah, this is the old retired Superman, so we can screw with him and make mm-hmm. him a dad and make him a husband, and no one cares because, you know, that's not our cool younger Superman who we're going to focus on. And then I love that the minute you bring this character into the DC universe, everyone says, we don't want the young, cool guy without the underpants on his outside. We want dad Superman with Lois as his wife. That's the guy we love. He's got so much heart. He's got so much grit. He loves his kids so much. They have such a good relationship. They're just such an awesome little family. And it just makes me so happy. It's the way Superman was meant to be. Much like Nick, I was never a huge Superman guy. You know, I can appreciate him, but I didn't like him. I am big into the current Superman. I think as the responsible dad and husband, he's just, you know, there's something about him you just love. And I almost thought about doing a combo pick of Superman and Pa Kent at number two, because I think so much of why Superman's such a great father character is because Pa Kent is just one of the all-time best father characters. But ultimately, I think Superman is so much more interesting. And it also came down to me, I was kind of wavering back and forth between Superman and Batman, which is crazy when you think about they're both fathers. But there's just something, again, I think like Batman, Batman's always had the father thing because, you know, you had Dick Grayson, you had all this stuff. Superman's still relatively new, and I just applaud the concept so much that I had to give him my my number two spot.
And so far, Superman hasn't been directly responsible for any of his children's deaths.
So far, fingers crossed.
Yeah, so what's worse, accidentally killing your kid or turning them into a serial killer?
Oof, that's a, not a lot of good parenting going on in Gotham. Just a terrible...
Just a shithole of a place.
Yeah, just a terrible place where, I mean... What did I say? I said on an episode of Masterclass, I think it was with one with Tim, and I'm like, Tony Stark's not very sympathetic. He's kind of a jerk. Batman's a rich guy, but why is he sympathetic? And Tim's just like, oh, because his parents are dead. I'm like, oh, yeah, right.
But everyone's parents are dead, I think. Or just horrible people. So
yeah, exactly. So there you go.
But this
Superman
is
at number two.
This is a great pick, Ben. I love this pick. Superman in the Rebirth era, I've talked about this on the podcast before. I reignited a love for Superman that I had when I was a kid that it completely vanished at a certain point. And I guess there was always that spark wanting to draw me back to Superman. But every time I would pick up Superman comics, I just could never get back into him, with a few Geoff Johns exceptions here and there, basically. But and I just hated the New 52 take on Superman.
Yeah, I mean, can we just put it out there that New 52 Superman was a terrible idea? Awesome. Like, trying to make Superman cool, and I mean, look, this is the reason that the DC Cinematic Universe is in trouble, or beyond in trouble, is the fact that they're trying to make, they built it around trying to have like an edgy, dark, gritty Superman the same way they did in Rebirth, or not in Rebirth, in New 52, when at the end of the day, Superman is not that guy. He's Christopher Reeve. He's Dean Cain. He's Tom Welling. He's this likable, you know, oaf who's just like a good-hearted, good-natured farm boy. Like, I don't want to see Superman as a badass, ever. Like, that's just not, I'll take that back. The occasional moment where he cuts loose and does something really badass,
and beats up Darkseid or something.
Exactly. Yeah. But that's cool precisely because he doesn't do it all the time.
Right.
Like, I don't want a dark Superman. So that
T-shirt Jane Superman, not for me.
Yep.
No. Oh man, that was rough. I did not like that at all. So yeah, give me married Superman. Give me father Superman. Mm-hmm. He's the dude, and I'm really enjoying the current run of Superman. Can't wait to see, like you guys, what Bendis does with the whole family concept.
Yeah, and it really did spark a new love for Superman. And it reminded me of when I was a kid, and the two comics on the stands I couldn't wait to buy were X-Men and Superman. And I don't know why it was those particular brands, but when I was 7, 8 years old, those were by far my favorite lines of comics to read. So it's nice to be back in the Superman fold once again. So let's move on to you, Nick, for your number two selection.
All right. So from one entry on Ben's list that I had already talked about, let's go to an entry on my list that, Greg, you had already talked about. And as I alluded to earlier, my number two dad in comics is Ben Parker. But while you spent your time talking about the mainstream, the 616 version of the character, I'm going to throw all my love to Ultimate Ben Parker. And the reason for that is something that you guys both alluded to, in that...
The ponytail?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say the ponytail.
He kind of looks a lot... He kind of has a beast-like look about him between the ponytail and the glasses, but we'll punt that down the road. But you guys alluded to the fact that the main version of Uncle Ben is a character we don't really get to spend a lot of time with firsthand. You know, he's in that Amazing Fantasy 15 origin, and from there on out, we pretty much are only seeing flashbacks or the impact he's had on Peter. Ultimate Spider-Man gives us a little bit more of an opportunity to get to know Ben Parker as a guy, whether it is in those first few issues or later during the Venom storyline when we get to see, like, home movies of him interacting with Richard Parker and stuff. And you get this fuller picture to me of a guy who is doing the best he can. He was a guy who never asked to be a parent, who possibly never even wanted to be a parent, and yet he finds himself in this set of circumstances where there's always going to be this element in his mind of, but I'm not his real dad, but I'm not, you know, he wouldn't even be here. He doesn't really want to be here. He wants to be with his parents. He doesn't, like, this kid, you know, I don't know what to do with him. And yet that doesn't stop him from trying to be the best dad he knows how to be. Whether it is, you know, trying to pick Peter up and dust his shoulders off when he's getting picked on at the mall, or whether it's trying to feed Peter opportunities to hit on Mary Jane, Ben Parker, in the pages of Ultimate Spider-Man, is just a cool dude who is giving it the best go he knows how. And the impact he has on Peter is something we also see in the pages of Ultimate Spider-Man for, you know, over 100 issues. And I gotta tell you, when they finally got to Death of Spider-Man, that Mark Bagley cover of Peter and Uncle Ben with his arm around Peter walking into the white light is like one of my favorite artistic images in the history of comics. I own that issue. I think I own like 3 copies because of how much I love that cover. It is indelible in terms of the impact it left on me. So I know Greg, you don't have as much experience with the Ultimate Universe as I do, but that was my formative years. That's what got me into comics. So I have to throw some love to Ultimate Ben Parker.
Ultimate Ben Parker is great, wonderful reinvention on the concept, and such a smart thing when Bendis did Ultimate Spider-Man to start. Just like, how do you take the best origin in the history of comics and do something more with it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do it over the course of several issues and really dig into the stuff that they only had a few pages to do in Amazing Fantasy. You guys talked about on Marvel Age, like, how incredible it is that the origin of Spider-Man and all that stuff that happens to him is packed into so few pages in Amazing Fantasy. When it really gets to breathe as an origin, you really fall in love with Ben Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so much more. And it's so hard because you know what's coming.
Yes.
That was the hardest part about reading Ultimate Spider-Man, is like, you know what has to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
And Bendis just really twisted the knife all the more because he made Ben Parker such a cool guy. I will say, I already talked about, you know, the other version of Ben Parker, so I won't go too much more into it. I will just say that between Luke Cage, Ultimate Ben Parker, it's not a coincidence. Brian Bendis, the person, is one of the greatest dads ever. He's so good to his kids. and just a wonderful human being.
See, these are the kinds of insights that you can't get from the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
Nope.
Sent me every year I was at Marvel, would send literally every person at Marvel. I'm sorry if I'm breaking the news here, Brian, but he would send us all Christmas gifts.
Wow.
These bags of popcorn that I didn't think existed outside of Brian Bendis's house. And then I was at a supermarket here in Vegas, and I saw them, and I was like, oh, my God, and I tweeted it out. And Bendis was like, yeah, no, they're real. I'm like, yeah, no, I get it. But he sent those to us every year, and everyone at Marvel felt so special because whether you were – the editorial director of digital media, right on down to, like, you know, a bullpen member who'd only been there for a year, you got a present from Brian Bendis because he's just the nicest guy in the world.
Well, that's awesome to hear, man, because, like, I would not be sitting here doing this podcast with you guys if it were not for Brian Bendis. So it's good to hear that one of the guys I look up to in comics seems to be a cool dude.
Very cool guy. Definitely one of those cases of it's worth it to meet your heroes because he's a great guy.
Awesome.
Absolutely. And he's my number one best dad. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, let's get to my number one selection here. And before we do, I'll count down appropriately enough my five to this point. I had at number five that rat bastard chain smoking Jim Gordon. At number four, I had that child ignoring. Choosing one kid over the other, Ted Knight.
Philandering, too,
with the damned Black Canary.
Yeah. Jim Gordon, also a philanderer.
That's true.
That's a great point. Prominent
philanderer. No moral fiber on the Greg Phillips list for this podcast.
Nothing but Frank Miller characterizations all across the board. Number three, I had Ben Parker, Uncle Ben. Not just known for his rice, but for his parenting.
Yep.
At number
Turn your
two,
list around.
At number two, I have John Custer. Fuck communism. And at number one, I have. I don't think this is any surprise to Nick. I have Jonathan Pa Kent.
Now let me number one. Let me tell you what is surprising to me. Before you jump in, though, the fact that of the three people doing this podcast, you're by far the biggest Superman fan, and you didn't have Superman on your list. That is surprising.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, it's funny you mention that. When I made that crack earlier about the Jimmy Olsen cover, I was being legit. I just couldn't get the image out of my mind. I could not get the image out of my mind. I'm going to read this panel. It's so amazing. This cover, Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, number 30. Jimmy, this gift you got me for Father's Day makes me sorry I ever adopted you as my son. I'll have to destroy it to teach you a lesson. It just doesn't get any better than that.
From the Odin School of Parenting.
So I didn't include Superman, even though I'm absolutely on board with both of you including him on your list. I've loved this Rebirth Superman, but to me it comes down to the ultimate best dad in comics, and he's not from the Ultimate Universe. He is from the DC Universe, and for me, Jonathan Kent. Again, a lot of this will come down to the era that I grew up reading comics, because there are generations of Superman fans that grew up with a version of Superman where the Kents are dead for the most part when he's Superman. I grew up in the John Byrne era. And really the post-John Byrne era of the Dan Jurgens, Jerry Ordways of the world, where the Kents were not only alive, but the Kents were an integral part of Clark Kent's life, not just from the time that he arrives on Earth, but on through his years of superheroics. Because throughout every single trial and tribulation along the way in the post-crisis era, the one constant in his life, whether he's having a spat with Lois, whether he's been killed and brought back to life, every single issue that arrives to him, he can always turn to his parents as his rock. And Jonathan, even more so than Martha, is that guiding moral light for him that shows him not how to be a Superman, but how to be a man, first and foremost. And I think you see that in any adaptation of Superman, from the very early age. That this is a as you talked about with Uncle Ben and Aunt May, this is an old, kindly couple. I mean, they're it's clear up front that this is an old couple that can't have kids. And they've wanted kids, but they can't have any. And so they're kind of resigned to that. And Kal-El arrives on Earth and is like this answered prayer for Martha. But I think if you look back at the panels from various origins over the years, many artists have gone with the interpretation of Martha, and we saw this in John Byrne's Man of Steel recently, Martha is super excited about this happening, and Jonathan's kind of, you know, got this worried look on his face. Like, the first thing that he's thinking of is, who's going to tend the fields?
Yeah.
How are we going to pay the bills, you know? But he does it. He adopts this son, and he loves him, and he guides him, and he teaches him hard lessons when he needs to be taught hard lessons. You know, don't join the football team is that ever loving Superman trope, right? In every adaptation, don't abuse your powers for personal gain. And he teaches him all these lessons along the way, and he does it in a loving manner. And he creates, to me, I think the ideal, if Superman is the superhero that is the most inspirational or aspirational superhero of, like, that's who we strive to be like, even though we see ourselves more like Peter Parker or our darker selves being more like Batman, I think Jonathan Kent is like that from a fatherly perspective. I know that if I ever have kids, I would hope to be like Jonathan Kent because as Nick alluded to earlier, he is kind of like that perfect parent. Yes, he's that ideal, but he's also an example that sometimes if you're a good person and you treat people right, and you genuinely try to do the right thing, it will rub off on others. And in this case, it rubs off on his son, who could have easily grown up to become a tyrant, right?
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100% on that. I also grew up in the era of the post-crisis Superman where, you know, Jonathan and Martha were still alive. They were still vital. I thought that was a great addition to the mythos. I think maybe my first exposure to Superman... I think I read the comics first, but definitely the first place I really came to love Superman was the Lois and Clark
mm-hmm.
show.
Yes.
And I loved the Kents on that show.
They were amazing.
They were just so great. I will throw out that one of the most ridiculous, and yet it worked because of how much you love Paul Kent, issues in the history of Superman was Adventures of Superman number 500.
Mm-hmm.
Superman was dead, and him and Pa Kent fought back to back against the hordes of hell.
Yep,
so that
literally.
Superman could go to heaven. It's so absurd. But that bond between Clark and Jonathan is so heartfelt and realistic that I believed every second of it.
I had two copies of that book.
Yeah. We had two copies of every Death of Superman thing because that was going to put our kids through college.
Exactly.
Years later, when that rat bastard Jeff Johns killed Jonathan Kent, it was a really emotional story, and I was just like, man, it was a heart tugger, and I agree.
It felt like a truly earned moment because we had lived with Pa Kent in our lives for so long.
Yeah, it was so hard to say goodbye to him. I think that's what puts Pa Kent into the echelon. I think makes him a legitimate number one on your list. Is that as great as Uncle Ben was, we even with Ultimate Spider-Man only got a few issues of him.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Pa Kent, whether it's through the time he was alive post-crisis or Silver Age Superboy stories, like we know Pa Kent. He's a real character, and also he's been a vital part of multimedia adaptations of Superman, whether it's Lois and Clark, whether it's Smallville, where John Schneider was a great Pa Kent.
Oh, he's my favorite Pa Kent, I think.
Yeah, he was an awesome Pa Kent. It's well-earned, very, very good number one pick.
And I want to throw out a shout-out to a creator as well, because if we're talking about Jonathan Kent, the creator, for some reason, that pops out the most in my mind is Louise Simonson. She wrote the Kents, particularly in the Death of Superman era, Funeral for a Friend. There's the scene when Lois go, you see, you actually see the Kents watching the funeral on TV.
Yes.
And they can't go to their son's funeral because it would reveal that he's Superman. So,
oh my God, that's such a good moment. Good callback.
Incredible. So anyway, that's my selection. Let's move on to Nick, do you have anything to add?
No, I saw your selection coming a mile away, knowing you and your preferences, but great choice.
Sounded so dismissive and mean.
That's, yeah. You learn to deal with that if you're a friend of Nick's. So, Ben, let's go to your number one selection. And before you name it, give a countdown of your picks up to now.
Sure. So on my list, we have had Odin, Wally West, Luke Cage, and Superman, which leads to the number one. And for my number one best father in the history of comics, I have to give a little context that the worst father in the history of comics is undoubtedly Scott Summers, a.k.a. Cyclops.
He's pretty bad.
Who not only abandoned his wife and child to get back together with his ex-girlfriend, who not only sent his son to the future, not knowing any idea of what was going to happen to him, who not only has just been a general bad dad at every turn, it's the worst father in the history. Terrible father to Nathan Summers, terrible father to Rachel Summers, terrible father to any other alternate reality kids that have come along. So that is why it's all the more remarkable that the greatest father in the history of comics is Cyclops' son, Cable.
Nice.
AKA Nathan Summers. This is a guy who has one daughter, not his daughter by blood, adopted basically, and spent literal decades raising this child, protecting this child, sacrificing any semblance of a good or normal life so that he would come in. And the great thing about the story of Cable, and this is, I'll fully admit, I'm biased to this because it took place during the time I was at Marvel, the story of Cable the dad. But just the transformation of Cable the character from this grizzled 90s cliche into this three-dimensional, fleshed-out, loving father who would do anything for his daughter. And I would argue that the character of Cable in the late 2000s into the present day has been more defined when he's at his best, by his relationship with Hope and what a good father he is and how loving he is. And the most, it's so devastating that he after years of suffering, years of war, years of fighting, all the battles of the apocalypse, strife, etc., Cable found peace and happiness in the future, raising Hope as his daughter, married, and just settled down. And then had it ripped away from him by Bishop. And just to me, it was one of the saddest stories when he loses his wife. But he recognizes that the most important thing is not his own happiness. It's to protect his child. And he continues to do that all the way through the brilliant Cable series, super underrated, that Dwayne Straczynski wrote. Every issue of that, the relationship between Cable and Hope is fantastic. He comes back to the present day. Sacrifices himself to save Hope in Messiah Complex, not Messiah Complex, whatever X-Men crossover Cable died in. he sacrifices himself. It's a great sacrifice, even though I can't remember the name of the story. But
there's so many.
Then eventually he comes back and just bonds with Hope again. And just to me, I just love it. I know it's not a conventional pick by any means. And he's not Jonathan Kent. He's not Uncle Ben. I just love the idea that Cable, who when I was a kid in the 90s, was just the epitome representation of pretty much everything that was overboard and excessive about the 90s characters, to the point where you look at Kingdom Come, which by Mark Waid and Alex Ross, which is kind of a condemnation in many ways of the 90s, and you had Magog, who was basically Cable. Like, he was just this avatar of everything that was bad, like big guns, pouches, everything. just reckless, wants to kill everybody, to make him the father figure of the X-Men universe. I loved it. And to be fair, because I gave Greg so much shit about Commissioner Gordon, Cable did also raise a son
who Tyler.
Ended up being a full-on supervillain. So
Genesis, yeah.
Yeah, he was Genesis. He did not bat 100, but I don't know. I wanted to make a statement by saying that Cable, to me, God, he tries so hard. And just for listeners of this podcast who may have not read the Cable series from, I think it was around like 2010 or so, underrated series. Really good, really strong, really good concept. And I think, honestly, saved Cable as a character. I don't think he had much gas left in the tank as his original incarnation. I think the relationship with Hope bought him a few more years so he could kind of get back to being really one of the best characters in X-Men history.
That's awesome. And it sounds like we should add that to our list of long book hunts, Nick, which I feel like is growing by the day. It's intriguing to me. I really like that concept. Now, let me ask you this, Ben. Have you seen Deadpool 2 yet?
No, I have not seen Deadpool 2 yet. I have an 11-month-old, so movies are few and far between for me. I'm hoping to see it soon. But, yeah, part of the reason I want to see Deadpool so badly is because I cannot wait to see Josh Brolin's take on Cable.
I think you'll be happy with it. I'll put it that way. Now, that leaves us with one selection yet left. Nick, count us down your list so far, and then give us your number one.
Absolutely. So at number 5, I had Superman. At 4, I had that rat bastard Jim Gordon. At 3, I had Luke Cage. At 2, I had Uncle Ben, and more specifically, Ultimate Uncle Ben, if you want to be particular about it. And much like Greg's selection was predictable to me, I think Greg knows what my number one selection is going to be. Ben just talked about his favorite adoptive father in comics, and I'm going to talk about mine. Because, to me, my favorite character in comics is Batman. And he is defined by his relationship to his supporting characters in many ways. And to me, there is no greater relationship, no dynamic better over the course of many decades than that of Bruce Wayne and Alfred Pennyworth. And so I am going with Alfred Pennyworth as my best dad in comics. Does he instantly spring to mind when you think of dads in comics? Absolutely not.
Never.
But when you look back at it, he really was tasked with arguably one of the toughest parenting jobs of any character in either the Marvel or DC universes. He has got this child who has endured one of the greatest traumas and who is filled with an internal rage and a single-mindedness to basically take on this mission that could very easily, much like Spider-Man, turn into a villainous aim rather than a noble one. And he is tasked with guiding this child through his formative years and trying to shape that child into something that is not going to be ultimately defined by and broken by his experiences. And it's the result of Alfred's guiding hand, I think, that leads Bruce and helps Bruce to ultimately become what he winds up becoming. And unlike many people, like, for example, there's a point at which Pa Kent has done all he can do for Clark, and Clark has just got to stand on his own 2 feet as his own man. Bruce Wayne as a character is still, there's still a part of him inside that is that broken little boy. And that no matter how old he gets, he's still going to need that father figure in Alfred to be there to call him out when he's making mistakes and to console him when he's at his darkest moments. Alfred is a character who has given his entire life in service to this one family and is now forged this relationship with this child that he never anticipated. And for all those reasons, Alfred Pennyworth is my favorite dad in comics. While I was not a great fan of Grant Morrison's Batman run, or of Batman RIP specifically, it did give us that fantastic issue where Wonder Woman and Superman come to Wayne Manor to check on Alfred, and Superman asks him, "Alfred, are you all right?" And he says something to the effect of, "Of course I'm not all right, sir. My son has just died." And it is like, It rips your heart out the same way that Mark Bagley cover for Ultimate Death of Spider-Man rips my heart out. So I know it's not a traditional pick, but when I think of dads in comics, I always kind of think of Alfred Pennyworth.
I think it's a great pick because not only is Alfred a father to Bruce Wayne and Batman, which you've talked to, I want to talk about his relationship with my favorite comic book character, Dick Grayson.
Right.
He also kind of had to be a surrogate father for Dick because while Bruce sort of kind of has that role, yes, let's be honest, who's doing the hard stuff? Who is doing the caring and the empathizing and the sitting down and helping him with his homework and sitting down and literally feeding him and helping him know that things are going to be all right? It's Alfred. So here Alfred has already raised this one orphan who was orphaned by violence. Now he's got another orphaned by violence that he's raising. Then you add Jason Todd. Mm-hmm. Then you add Tim Drake, who kind of had his own father figure. Didn't really need Alfred to be that. But then you have Damian, who is just a totally separate entity. So Alfred has not only had to endure probably a more difficult plate of parenting than any other person. He still is there to support Bruce when he's going through these times of trouble. And of course, we just watched it the other day together, Nick, so I got to throw a shout out to
God Almighty.
My all-time favorite parenting scene in a superhero movie, which is actually a very sad, sad moment. When The Dark Knight Rises, when Alfred is at the grave of the Waynes and breaks down and talks about how he failed them because he was supposed to protect Bruce and he failed as a parent. It makes me cry every time I watch it. It's just such a powerful scene. So, Ben, your thoughts on Alfred?
Let's not also forget that he was, speaking of movies and speaking of father figures, his tremendous turn in Batman and Robin for Alicia Silverstone's Batgirl.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and dealing with McGregor syndrome. A very American.
God.
Yeah, no, that's a rare disease. You wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. No, this is a great pick. Unconventional, but yeah, Alfred in many ways, perhaps the most skilled and you guys said it best, the most challenging road of any father. Just like there's nothing tougher than raising Bruce Wayne and watching Bruce Wayne go out each and every night and yet somehow still finding the strength to be that credible father figure. It's a great pick. Definitely the best father in Gotham, which is just notorious for having terrible fathers. Jim Gordon could learn a thing or two from Alfred Pennyworth, for sure.
The only good father in Gotham had to come from outside Gotham.
Yeah, a British guy.
A British guy. And I do want to say this. He also is demonstrating that principle we talked about earlier with Ted Knight, in that he learns as he goes. Because, I mean, he made mistakes with his first surrogate son, and he got it right with the second one.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Anyway, that was for you, Nick. Sorry. Mm-hmm. just a little gem. But anyway, I definitely enjoyed this talk. This was awesome. I feel like we've all learned some things today about what makes a good parent. And importantly, what doesn't make a good parent?
Yeah, no, this podcast is really going to spur me on to be a better father.
to not be like Jim Gordon, essentially.
I just can't thank you guys enough for pointing me in the right direction. I really learned some valuable lessons tonight. Especially in what not to do. Thank you. Thank you, Hard Traveling Fanboys.
No, dude. Jim Gordon, but yes to exiling your daughter to other dimensions. That's what we've come down on, I think.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine.
That's all good. Well, I think we had a very eclectic collection of choices here. I mean, let's face it, our number ones were Pa Kent, Cable, and Alfred.
So there you go.
We had a wide selection here. Yeah.
None of those the natural fathers of their children. Yeah, all true. Adopted
That's a
parents,
great
which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's a great point. It takes more than biology to be a dad. So, thanks so much, Ben. We absolutely appreciate this. It's an honor to talk to you again, to have you on the show. You're doing great work as always. Tell the folks how they can find you on Twitter and other social media platforms.
Sure. You guys can find me on Twitter at Ben J. Morse. You can find me on Instagram at BenMorse882. I am part of the Places to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. And if you're looking to hear another chat from me about comics, go and visit unlv.edu/TEDxUNLV. I am, as of this podcast, 2 days away from delivering my TED Talk, which will be about comics. I hope everyone will go check it out. If this comes out beforehand, go check it out live, streaming on Friday, June 22nd. If this comes out after Friday, June 22nd, it is archived on that site I just directed you to. And guys, I want to thank you for having me on. This was an honor. This is truly the mothership legendary podcast of Place of the Nation. And it was a thrill to journey alongside you both.
The thrill was all ours. Yeah. I got to say, I think this was, what would you say, Nick? I think this might be a 5-star podcast.
Oh, man. It depends. It depends on whose star rating scale we're using. But yeah, this is definitely, you know, it's one of our better guest spots I think we've ever had.
Yeah.
I can say that. And we always have a blast when you come on the show. And now that you're an official member of the Place to Be Nation Pop family, we would love to have you on more often, of course, as your schedule allows. So we look forward to talking to you in the future. And I think I'm looking forward to my eventual spot on Masterclass, whenever that may happen.
Whenever that may happen. Yeah, no, I've listened to some of you guys' episodes. This is far and away the best episode in the history of your show. So I think, like, great job by all three of us in achieving excellence. And absolutely, I look forward to coming back in the future.
Absolutely, sir. So, thank you.
We're going to take a break here. And when we come back on the other side, we've got the rundown. We've got reading and watching. We've got the wrestling minute. We've just got a veritable cornucopia of comic book talkings. And thus, we bid you adieu for now.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to be Nation Pop, you are inside, theoretically, the L-shaped studio in Hoholoon Plaza in beautiful and serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
And of course you are here after having already been here for the first half of our show, which you've already heard now.
Absolutely. And I just like to remind all of our great listeners about what they're listening to while they're listening to it.
That's right. We have in no way traveled back in time and actually recorded this, you know, the first half after the second half or anything like that.
No. Think of this as kind of like Monday Night Raw, when even though you've been watching the show to that point, you get reminded twice during the show what happened at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, so like for us, you know, we would say something like, you know, in the first half of the show, you have heard live from the beautiful and serene Hoholoon Plaza, the illustrious Ben Morse, the information guru of Place to Be Nation Comics, bringing us his outstanding list of the top five fathers in comics.
A list that, if I may be so bold, Nick, puts both of ours to shame.
I agree. And puts anybody out there who might have a list, I would assume that it would also put theirs to shame as well.
And quite frankly, I would suggest, in my opinion, that this has been the case for us, Nick, since we started the show. I believe that we had Ben on, and we talked about this earlier, I'm sure. I've just forgotten.
Yeah.
We had him on to count down our favorite Marvel video games.
We did indeed.
And that was actually one of my favorite shows, legitimately. One of my favorite shows.
And not to mention, we had him on for a column way back when. That was one of my favorite columns.
Which one was that?
We had him on for our favorite couples in comics.
Oh, yeah. He actually, and it's timely because there's a big issue of X-Men that came out this week that was purported to feature the marriage of Colossus and Kitty Pryde, and I believe that was one of his five couples on his list. So.
And it was an outstanding choice, as all of his choices for his list are.
Absolutely. And yours were pretty good too, Nick.
Well, thanks, Greg. And, I don't know that I would put myself on that level, but thanks.
Mine were not very good, but
oh, they were pretty good.
I'll make them better in the future. And what I can say is, we are thankful.
What was great about mine, Greg, is how just tremendously different they were from the exact same countdown we did 4 years ago in the column.
You know, there's a lot to be said for that, Nick, because people have made accusations about us in the Twitter sphere, in the Facebook sphere, in the geosphere, and they've said about us, the hard traveling fanboys, that we are something of a lazy bunch. They're saying that occasionally we like to reuse concepts from the past, dredge them up, and here's what they've said. They've said that we have actually stooped so low as to repeat talking points from our own columns and podcasts
in the past. That is internet rumor and innuendo, and I am not going to respond to that. I'm not going to respond to it. I'm not going to dignify it with a response.
It doesn't deserve a response. But you know what does deserve a response? Our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comic books. It's a little segment we like to call Rundown.
Welcome to the Rundown.
Nick, we've got not a loaded show of the rundown here.
Not like last week. Last week was nuts, man. One of the heaviest rundowns in a long time.
Last week was insanity. But this week we've pared it down a little bit. We've got what we think are the big heavy hitter news stories of the week. So let's get right to it. What I think is probably the biggest story of the week. You know, we had talked recently about there were complications with the Disney and Fox. A merger that was going to affect potentially the future of superhero films. But a snag came along when Comcast came in and outbid Disney. Well, not to be outdone, quite literally, Disney has now countered that counter and increased it to a previously unforeseen billion dollar
yes, billion.
Offer. I had a Dr. Evil moment there. Million.
$71.3 million isn't a lot of money these days.
No, and it increases the total transaction amount to $85.1 billion when you include the $13.8 billion of Fox's net debt. I don't know what any of this financial stuff means, Nick. I'm not going to lie to you.
It means it's an assload of money that Disney is offering to buy Fox.
Yes. So it feels like, at least for now, Comcast has been knocked off the proverbial perch by Disney. So I guess wait and see.
Yeah, I suppose. It feels like we've been talking about the story for, months now, and it feels like it's just kind of rinse and repeat the same developments over and over again. They just kind of swing back and forth. So you've heard our thoughts here before. Greg, quarter million? I think a quarter million's a good number.
I think quarter million's legit. I mean, when you look at what we're doing in residuals and merchandising and
look at the Casper mattress deal by itself.
See, that's the thing. People didn't realize last week when we did that whole Casper mattress bit, people didn't realize that we were actually signing a contractual agreement with this company that was going to bring in so much money to the Place of Nation Pop feed. Mm-hmm. And another thing, Nick, I don't want to, toot our own horns, but toot. Look at all the spinoff podcasts we've created.
Oh my God. What are you doing? What are you even talking about? I mean,
we're like, we might as well be our own cinematic universe, except instead of cinemas, it's audio, and instead of making money, it's free.
Shut the front door.
Absolutely. So, if you're listening, executives at Disney and or Fox.
And or Comcast, if you need a nice consolation prize.
Hey!
You didn't get Fox, but look over here. Look what we have.
That money's got to go somewhere is the way I look at it. Why not invest in Space Nation Pop?
Why not?
And give us a chance to quit our miserable jobs.
With assets like Marvel Age, Hard Traveling Fanboys, and of course, Marvel Age Masterclass, how can you turn that down?
Indeed. And don't forget, occasional unannounced wrestling columns. So, anyway, we also have another development from Marvel. Speaking of Marvel Studios, which is a big factor in this whole Fox-Disney negotiation process, Marvel is forging ahead with a Black Widow movie. This is something we've talked about that's been overdue for many, many years now. Looks like it's finally going to happen. Deadline says that Australian director Kate Shortland, who I know nothing about, is on the studio's shortlist to do this. They are intent on making this happen. Great news, Nick. I can't wait for this movie.
Yeah, I'm excited for it as well. Probably a long time overdue, honestly. But, we're going to wind up getting it, and it's arguable that with all the rumored departures from the MCU that perhaps the timing actually is better now, and she'll be able to be elevated to a place among the, top two or three characters in the MCU rather than not saying she's not a bottom, that she's a bottom-tier character or anything, but she's certainly not been on the level of, the so-called big three of Hemsworth, Evans, and RDJ. So hopefully, with this solo movie and with the departures, she will only continue to expand her profile in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Absolutely. I agree with that a hundredfold, in fact. And, better late than never, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
So, well, let's go to the printed page here. And Marvel also made an announcement in the X-Men universe that X-Men Blue and X-Men Gold, which it feels like we just announced a few months ago, but has been around for quite some time. They're on issue 36.
Yeah.
They will both come to an end as of September. X-Men Blue has followed the adventures of the time-displaced X-Men, while X-Men Gold has worked with the core roster. Now the new team books will remain Astonishing X-Men, X-Men Red, and Weapon X. So, I note this really, I don't have much to say about it, but pretty substantial run for both of these books, I think. And, we'll see where it all goes from here. as far as the team developments, but I keep hearing that perhaps the time-displaced X-Men are going back to the past.
Yes. That, apparently that is part of an event, an X-related event that's coming up later this year that I can't remember the name of right now, but that's been pretty heavily teased, and I think some of the solicits are even saying as the stuff like as the time-displaced X-Men's time in the present draws to a close. So certainly seems like that's the direction it's going to go.
Well, I don't see any better way than to transition into my next story here on my list, which is it's prefaced by two simple questions, Nick. Mm-hmm. Number one, who do the Gory Bomb?
Okay, Chavo Guerrero.
Okay, and number two, hashtag who gets warped?
Tom Zink was a handsome young man.
That he was. This is a story about the announced debut of a series of one-shots called Infinity Warps.
And apparently they're not even one-shots.
What?
Yes,
oh, apparently. Two-shots.
It solicits read as one of two, so they're two-shots.
Yeah, two-shots, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what this is, Infinity Warps, is part of the Infinity Wars storyline that is ongoing. Mm-hmm. These characters will debut in number three. And basically, if you remember any 90s comics fans, the Amalgam Universe, mm-hmm. which was a mashup of DC and Marvel characters who were kind of squished together into new characters that carried their titles for a month or so. And it was, so you got things like Dark Claw that was a Batman and Wolverine hybrid. Bruce Wayne, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Iron Lantern.
JLX.
Lobo the Duck.
Well done, sir.
So,
well done.
So you got a lot of interesting characters at that time. Mm-hmm.
Super Soldier, I think. Wasn't Super Soldier the
yes,
Superman Captain America. America? Yep.
Yep. And Spider-Boy. Spider-Man and Superboy.
Yeah, which that together. One doesn't really, like, have any sound about it that makes it sound like Superboy. I mean, Spider-Boy could just be the name of a young Spider-Man,
right.
You know?
Exactly. That's a great point. I never thought about that. That's a great point. But here, Marvel is kind of taking that same concept and focusing it on its own universe. And they're doing the premise of the Infinity Gauntlet or the Infinity Stones mm-hmm. are causing reality to warp. And as part of this, we've got two announced mashup titles. One of them is an Iron Man Thor mashup called Iron Hammer, and the other one is a Captain America Doctor Strange combo called Soldier Supreme. Mm-hmm. These will launch in September. One written by Al Ewing and drawn by Ramon Rosanas, and the other one written by Jerry Duggan mm-hmm. and drawn by Adam Kubert. So, Nick, what do you make of this?
I don't really know what to make of it, because I haven't been following the build to Infinity Wars and probably will not read Infinity Wars. So I don't know what to make of it. I think it's silly, honestly, but I if it's just a short-term thing in the middle of an event, I don't see it as being drastically different than stuff
right.
like, God, remember all those Convergence two-parters
oh, yeah.
that DC released a few years ago, or for Secret Wars a few years back. Marvel had actually a lot of really good tie-in, standalone, miniseries. I don't think these will be, on the level of those Battle World series they did for Secret Wars, but I don't know. I'm not going to read them. I kind of shrug my shoulders and go, whatever.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way after thinking it over a little bit.
Yeah, because the initial announcement made it sound like it was going to be a more long-term thing than it is, It made it sound
right.
like it was going to be like an ongoing or
it was
full-on
another,
mini
like,
or something.
Yeah, another bombastic press release from a major comics company. So, but overall, after reading about it, it's not something I'm interested in at all. But
he's done some really good work in the last few years. If you remember me talking up a few years back that Loki Agent of Asgard series that I love so much, he wrote that. And so, the art teams are pretty good. Again, I'm not going to read them, but there's at least a chance they could be entertaining enough as, spinoff titles, essentially.
Yeah, and I thought about it, and I was like, what if this had been announced as like a what-if title? And I would have mm-hmm. been, that would be a pretty cool what-if. What if Doctor Strange and Captain America, or what if like Captain America had become the Sorcerer Supreme or something. So I can see it. And as long as it's not a long-term thing, because I wouldn't want to see – and really two issues feels like stretching it to me.
Yeah.
I feel like this could be told in one. But nonetheless, that's – you know, I don't have really any real issue with this.
Right.
But thought it was worth mentioning.
Yep.
Now, speaking of worth mentioning, I have to bring this up because
– I know where this is going.
Made a huge announcement this week, an announcement that will shake the DC Comics, and he will be doing so in Superman number 2, out on August 8th. Bendis says this was a challenge put to him, challenge accepted, and not only that, Ivan Reis is drawing the god dang Nuclear Man. Now, here's the question I have, Nick. Was it the Nuclear Man just kind of a low-rent Firestorm in the first place? Also called the
I cannot answer that question because I probably haven't seen Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Ever.
God, when did it come out? It came out in
1986, I believe.
Okay, if it came out in 86 or 87, I saw it in like 90 or 91. I was 3 or 4 when I saw it and have never watched it again. So, I remember nothing about it other than the fact that even as a kid, I thought it was kind of boring.
You mean you don't remember the Nuclear Man's power?
I remember that it was based on him being nuclear.
Well, I think the real thing here is we need to make sure that Lex Luthor's original plot for him carries through in the comic page. Because you see, if he scratches Superman, he'll become sick. Yeah. His nose will run. He'll be stuck in bed and he'll lose his job. It's perfect, Nick.
If you say so, sir.
I do say so. It's going to be wonderful. Now, wonderful. There's no way to transition from the word wonderful into this next story.
Sorry for that. I am laughing at the dark humor of Greg's botched transition. Go ahead, Greg.
DC Comics is getting ready to have a panel at San Diego Comic-Con, which is a comic book convention, as you may or may not know. And it was originally set to be hosted by Talking Dead host Chris Hardwick.
Well,
also founder of The Nerdist. Well, that ain't gonna happen.
Nope.
According to The Wrap, Warner Brothers plans to debut trailers for Aquaman and Shazam, which we probably should have included in the rundown now that I've seen it. But let's forget about that and move along. Hardwick was going to moderate it, but he will not now. He's been pulled, according to this. And this is amid accusations that came out this past week of sexual assault and harassment levied against him by his former girlfriend, Chloe Dykstra. Hardwick's program, Talking, on AMC has already been suspended since the accusations were made public. He has been wiped from all Nerdist website material. I mean, what do you want to say about this, Nick?
Not much. You know, obviously there's always an element of innocent until proven guilty. But I think for the time being, the best thing for all parties involved, whether that be Nerdist, DC, AMC, what have you, is probably just to, at best, put their relationship with Hardwick on a bit of a hiatus.
Absolutely.
If not outright sever those ties, depending on your corporate views and stuff. For me, I got to be honest, Chris Hardwick, one of those guys in nerd culture that I never really understood the fascination with, you know, like, he had taken on the same role as like Kevin Smith has in recent years of just randomly always being around things that he didn't really have any involvement with, except he had not done anything in like any industry to warrant that. You know what I mean? It seemed like a really weird thing. And I was never the biggest fan. Like, he was fine and stuff, but I thought Talking Dead was god awfully boring most of the time. And I never saw any Talking. And you know what? If all this stuff is true, no real loss in my book.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing we have to be careful with is it really doesn't matter how talented he was. It could have been
somebody,
Kevin Smith. It could have been, I don't know, Gandhi. But if you're who was a pretty talented comic book artist in his own right, mm-hmm. as I understand it.
He was actually the artist on Peter David's Miles Morales book.
Yes, he was, which is amazing because it came out so many years after his death. But people don't realize.
Well, we hear at Place to Be Nation Pop, and especially in Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, as you heard earlier, we have a time machine, so we can make all kinds of things happen.
But nonetheless, it doesn't really matter how talented someone is. If they if he's guilty of what he's accused of, then you know he needs to be toast
for sure. So, I didn't mean to imply that like you know. So. I did not mean to imply that it.
Right. I know what you're getting at. I just wanted to clarify for the listeners. I know exactly what you meant, and you know, I liked Hardwick's hosting duties and stuff. I always found him, you know, a good host of things, but you know, it not good. None of this is good, and hopefully, everything works out for everyone involved the way that it should. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Unless you have anything else to add.
No.
Very good. Let's move on. Thank God. So let's transition into a much happier topic, which is, of course, our longest-running segment, a segment where we tell you what we've been reading and watching this past week from the world of comics. And it's a segment that you and I both know, Nick, as Read and Watch.
Read on and watch on. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
So, Nick, what you been reading?
I've been reading stuff for the Marvel Age podcast, which we should have episode 4 coming to you pretty soon after you hear this podcast, probably. But other than that, the only thing I was able to read from a modern context this week was Doomsday Clock number 5, which Greg read a couple weeks ago and gave his thoughts on. I will echo those. It's just amazing. I mean, the way this story is building, the attention to detail from Gary Frank on the art, all these different character interactions that I never knew I wanted to see as it relates to the DC Universe interacting with the characters of Watchmen. Everything's been great so far. I think the mystery of what exactly is the nature of everything and, you know, how this all ties together is starting to pick up for me. And I'm really intrigued to see where they go from here. We got another 7 issues of this book, and can't wait for those to hit my my local comic shop each and every time they come out. So, yeah, nothing but great things to say about Doomsday Clock number 5.
The beautiful thing about this is that how it's kind of turned all my initial theories on their head as it's gone along. And
I got a crazy one. I got a crazy initial theory. You know, so in this one, you know, spoilers, but Luther makes reference to the fact that whoever is behind all this used to be a member of the Justice League, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if it's New 52 Superman?
Oh, interesting.
Driving home that entire, like, point of Rebirth in the first place, which was to draw that distinction between the way things should be and the way they had become in the New 52. Mm-hmm. So have Dr. Manhattan either have directly inhabited the body of the New 52 Superman at one point, or been directly responsible for the changes to that character that had so many fans upset over the years.
Very interesting. Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And the beautiful part about this is there's always the possibility that Lex is just lying his ass off.
That's true.
You know, like, you just never really know. And that's a great part of this. And I'm particularly fascinated by this Nathaniel Dusk subplot, because it feels like it's right out of Watchmen, in that it on its surface, it seems to not have any tie to anything that's going on, but you just get the feeling that it's going to pay off in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Hell, they even got me to care about freaking Johnny Thunder, of all things. So,
yep.
You know.
Man, I totally thought he was about to get the Hollis Mason treatment, too. But
I did, too. But that's a nice job by Jeff Johns of subverting expectations, because you're set up to have all these parallels to Watchmen, and you think you've seen this scene play out, and then, you know, it flips.
Now, if Jeff really wants to tickle our fancy, though, instead of just bringing back Alan Scott, he needs to also bring back Doibie Dickles, right?
Oh, Doibie Dickles. Yes, absolutely. And then we can get a little old Justice on the comic page again. That'd be the stuff.
That's what I want right here. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, anything else you've been reading? That's it?
That's it.
All right. Well, I didn't read anything this past week.
There you are.
Except for getting ready for next week's episode of HTF, which we'll talk about in a minute. But let's move on to watching. And the only thing that I watched, Nick, that I can think of is last week's episode of Supergirl. So mm-hmm. not the finale.
Nope.
Which airs this week.
Yep.
But the Aired this week, yes. But last week's episode, which is the setup for the finale.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to give away too many of the details for people that haven't watched the show yet, but this was a lot to do with Rain returning on Earth. I don't want to spoil how they do this exactly, but it's pretty interesting the way that they're doing this and separating Rain from Samantha a little bit while also tying them together. And again, another good episode, I thought, Nick. You know, there's an element of it, and I think this happens to the CW shows sometimes towards the end of the seasons. Sometimes the end of the season tends to feel a little bit rushed. But most of this worked for me, I have to say. I enjoyed all the character interactions here, enjoyed seeing Jean and his dad decide to step up into the fight. I'm glad that Erica Durance as Kara's mom comes to Earth in this one. I was happy to see all the developments here, and I'm very curious about how the status quo was going to be in the season finale at the end of it.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, you had the Jean and his dad moments that hit big for me. The relationship between Kara and her birth mom, which has been good so far during its reintroduction to the show. Pretty much everything going on here worked for me. I do not like the reliance on that Coalfield or whatever his name character that continues to pop up. But
I think we don't have to worry about that.
Thankfully. I do think, however, that in the season finale we will see an untimely end for our Samantha that we love so good.
Oh, I think so, too. And it's going to be unfortunate. She's been a really good – it feels like every year now on Supergirl, they introduce this one or two new characters that just end up feeling essential to the show. Last year it was Mon-El.
I will throw out one minor criticism, however.
Sure.
I don't know what the overall plot of Season 4 is going to be, but the last three episodes do not need to be focused on evil Kryptonians on Earth.
Yes,
we've seen it
100%.
We have seen
it
three consecutive years. Yes, you can say, oh, but actually, they're Daxamites. Whatever, they were Kryptonians.
Daxamites were Kryptonians.
Yeah, shut up. Like that doesn't matter. You know, it's give us something new and different. Do what the Flash did this season. Shake things up a bit. and
show us a little ruthless aggression.
A little ruthless aggression. Give us something different for the close of season four. I'm kind of tired of the Kryptonian thing because, as we've discussed before, the more Kryptonians there are, the less special it makes Kara and Clark, in my opinion.
Why not? And this is just spitballing here. I wouldn't mind seeing Kara have to face a speedster and Barry have to face a Kryptonian or someone of that ilk.
Mm-hmm.
Which I know they kind of did that on The Flash by giving the Thinker so many different powers towards the end of the season. But you know what I'm saying. Doing their version of a Kryptonian invasion or something. I think that might be interesting. We haven't seen Kara have to deal with the speedster villain, so that would be interesting. So I don't know, just a thought. I'm sure there are plenty of other villains to pull on from the Superman pantheon and the Supergirl pantheon.
There are always villains to pull on.
I'm going to refrain from making an extremely inappropriate joke here.
Now, wait a minute.
Oh, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Why not?
I refuse to do it because I'll incriminate myself or incriminate our podcast.
Now I got to hear it.
I'll tell you off the air.
Oh, there you have it, folks. Greg Phillips is a damned cock tease when it comes to inappropriate humor.
So, I can't help but notice, though, Nick,
yes.
As you were talking, I looked up at the clock that's on my wall here. You know, last week I think I said it was a grandfather clock, but I traded that in and got a regular clock and put it on the wall. And I can't help but notice that there's a minute on the clock somehow. That could only mean it's time for the Wrestling Minute. What you got, Nick?
Oh, lots of things. Phenomenal episodes of SmackDown and a great Money in the Bank pay-per-view, I thought. Not a great pay-per-view, but a very solid pay-per-view. Not to mention the announcements of the New Japan Pro Wrestling G1 Climax 2018 cards, which I, as a new subscriber to the New Japan World Network, am extremely excited for.
Yes, and all of those events will have English commentary, which is a big deal. So that's all very cool to keep up with. Also, we can't not mention NXT TakeOver on Saturday night.
Oh, man, almost completely slipped my mind.
What a phenomenal show from beginning to end. One of the great matches of the year at the end. Also, other not just that match, though. Every match on the card delivered in a big way.
Agreed completely.
And we are getting ready next week, actually, for next week's episode. We will be talking all about our trip to Daytona coming up that weekend, so be on the lookout for that.
Yeah, 2 weeks from now. The episode 2 weeks from now.
That's right. That's right. With that being said, that's the end of the Wrestling Minute, or the Wrestling Minute. I'm sorry, I don't know why I called it the Wrestling Minute. What the hell is wrestling? That wrestling is what
my father did.
Wrestling is what the Hard Traveling Fanboys do.
That's right.
We like to get greased up, oiled up, and we like to wrestle.
For 60 minutes.
In a WWF Iron Man match.
For the WWF Championship.
God, I'm sick of it. Sick of all of it. The chair, all of it. We need to get Earl Hebner on this show. You know, if there was one guest that could surpass Ben Morris for us.
Oh, man.
Or, I don't know if you heard. Speaking of which, one of our distinguished competition over at Geek and Sassy Podcast, friends of the show, are apparently angling to get George Lucas himself on the show.
Wow. I mean, maybe that's a bigger draw than Ben Morris, but I doubt it.
I don't know. But if there's one that we could get, I think Earl Hebner would qualify. Because, listen, when it comes to hard-hitting comic book analysis...
After hearing your Earl impression again, it made me wonder, do you think Earl Hebner has ever had sexual relations with anyone behind a food line?
Do you think Earl Hebner might be the biological father of an individual who has guested on Comic Book Theater?
You know, I think there's a distinct possibility there. I think both like to sell gimmicks out of the back of their cars. You know,
that's right.
It's just part of the deal.
It is. Referring, of course, to famed French actor Gérard Depardieu.
Of course.
So, with that being said, we have next week coming your way a review by listener request. This comes from our listener, Mike. And I can't remember your Twitter handle off the top of my head, Mike, but a long time listener.
You know who you are, sir.
You know who you are. You requested us to review Ed Brubaker and Michael Lark's Daredevil, The Devil in Cell Block D. So we are looking at that right now on Marvel Unlimited, and we'll have that for our long book hunt next
Mike
week.
Mike is at FrankFran29.
At FrankFran29. How do you get Mike out of FrankFran29? I don't know. But
quite frankly, that's not for us to say.
It's not for us to say either. So I feel like this is going to be a good episode next week because I can just spoil it right now for you, Mike, and other listeners out there. I'm only an issue in, but this is amazing so far. Probably my favorite issue of Daredevil that I've read to date. So, and that covers some ground now. So, looking forward to this episode. Nick, what else do we have coming the folks' way up here in the near future?
I don't remember. Oh, I remember. In the month of July, we of course have Dark Knight Month. We are going to be taking a very special retrospective look back at Chris Nolan's The Dark Knight Trilogy in celebration of the 10th anniversary of what many consider to be the greatest comic book movie of all time, that, of course, being 2008's The Dark Knight. So we're going to bring you three very special editions of Off the Page, focusing on Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises, respectively, and then wrapping up the month of July with a countdown of our five favorite scenes in the trilogy. And we will, of course, be joined along the way by various special guests that we will tell you about at a later date.
At a later time. And when we say special guests, we mean only the most special of guests. These are guests that are the best guests. Mm-hmm. They have their own space force, in mm-hmm. fact, mm-hmm. Between them. So just a little hint of what's to come here on the show. Anything else for our dear and adoring public, Nick, before we let them go for this evening?
No.
Yeah, I got nothing either. Keep cool, my friends, and listen to a little bit of Conway this week. That's my homework for all of you out there, unless you hate country music and or Conway Twitty. Listen to Conway Twitty, or don't.
No, I mean, no. Honestly, we're gonna go with do. We're gonna say yes. Listen to Conway Twitty, and specifically, we want you to listen to what I call the creepy Conway song. So we want. I can tell you've never been this far.
Been this far before.
We want that one. We want Love to Lay You Down. Let's see what else do we want.
Linda on My Mind.
Linda on My Mind. Absolutely, great pull, sir.
Yes. Tight fitting jeans.
Tight fitting, but that's not really creepy. I mean,
that's true. Well, I guess that's true. Yeah, because he's talking about, you know.
No, wait a minute. Now that I think
about this far before, that is the one. Yeah.
No, that's they're different songs. Tight fitting jeans is talking about it's a song about a millionaire woman who goes out dressed like a common redneck in tight-fitting jeans because she wants to cheat on her husband with Conway Twitty. So, yes, we're going to add tight-fitting jeans to the homework list.
A cowboy once had a millionaire's dream.
That night I loved a lady wearing tight-fitting jeans. And how did you love her while she was wearing the jeans?
While you were wearing tight-fitting jeans. I mean,
now that's a great
Conway
point.
Switched to some tight-fitting
and jeans. Then he just pulled...
pulled it through the... God, what is happening?
Oh, man. Now I have that visual in my head, and I can't get rid of it.
I never wanted to think about Conway Twitty's penis. Thanks a lot.
I wonder if he has a minnow bucket.
Well,
what better way to end it than...
Anyway, folks, we hope you enjoyed this last and final edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We'll be back for you next week.
Spread out her fantasy before my eyes, it seemed. A cowgirl came alive inside those tight-fitting jeans. In my mind, she's still a lady. That's all I'm gonna say. I knew that I'd been broken by the time we parted ways. And I know I held more woman than most eyes have ever seen. That night I knew a lady wearing tight-fitting jeans. Well, now she's back in her world, and I'm still stuck in mine. But I know I'll always remember the time a cowboy once had a millionaire's dream. Lord, I love that lady wearing tight-fitting jeans.